Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Vowell, on faculty at the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director of the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Jack. Doing great.
As the birds chirp right outside the window.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's like a fairy tale land out here. Yesterday, the students were getting distracted because while you were reading, there were just deer walking in the woods.
Deer walking right beyond the windows. There, but yes, today I saw two fawns and a mother, not 20 feet from me as I drove in, and they looked like they didn't want to run away if I didn't bother them, and I wasn't going to bother them. So we got to look at each other for a little while.
Good man.
It was lovely. It was just lovely. Beautiful animals. Yes. At first, I could only see one of them. The other one of the fawns. The other one. Was lying down in the leaves, and they just was invisible, completely invisible.
I can't imagine this place if it, like, snows. It's going to be quite a sight. Of course, trying to get up the driveway is also going to be quite a sight.
Yeah, there is a little hill there, isn't there, in the driveway. We'll see how that goes. This will be our first, I guess we had January and February last year here, but I don't know if we had a lot of snow.
No.
We didn't last year.
Around here, snow is like a manna from heaven situation around these parts. Like
rare.
When it falls, it's just like, but don't cling to it. Don't keep those snowballs in your freezer. When we last left our listeners, we sort of ended our discussion because we led to the issue of, like, gender theory and modern conceptions of gender and all that kind of confusing stuff. Mm-hmm. And we ended saying we would try to talk about, you know, it's easy to, like, want to poke at gender theory and critique it because it's ultimately nihilistic about the human identity and knowledge and a whole bunch of other stuff. Therefore, it's easy to sort of poke at it and it crumbles to the ground. But trying to posit a Christian alternative seems tricky and dicey and difficult and all kinds of other things. So we thought we would try to, not take a stab at it in the sense like, well, we have a good, here's our idea. It's more like try to stay in that territory of let's posit as best we can or think about as best we can a sort of Christian anthropology about human sexuality.
It's interesting that you bring this up again because last Sunday, the question around the table for our listeners who weren't there, was about this very thing, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It actually happens to have been. How did he word it? Said something like,
"Are there any good men left?"
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Were there more good men around in the past than there are today? That kind of thing. And of course, we had to define our terms, like we always do.
And we spent most of our time centering around that.
About what the definition of a good man is.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. And so we didn't actually get to the question of are there more of them today than yesterday.
Yeah.
But it did lead us to the kind of conversation that I think you want to drive, you want to have here about the gender theory, because it is kind of confusing these days. What does it mean to be masculine? What does it mean to be feminine? And the argument that we get is one that it separates human sex from human gender.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard this argument,
yes,
I know, before.
The most basic thing.
That's the sort of thing that I hear more and more, that the two of those terms actually address different things. Let's define the terms first.
Okay.
The argument I hear is sex is a biological thing, and everybody is either biologically male or female.
Right.
Gender, on the other hand, is something that comes out of the nurture of your life. That is not nature, but nurture, and it's fluid. That you can act like a man in this society. You can act like a woman in this society, and somehow that doesn't necessarily equate to your biological gender.
Right. Sex is something. Sex is biological. It's grounded in the body, but gender is a construct. It's socially constructed. It's social norms. It's whatever categories and terms your social discourse produces for it and says about it.
And if you think that masculinity and femininity under that general definition of gender is the equivalent of boys like blue and girls like pink or something.
Right.
Well, then you can understand why people want to have a category there, it seems like, because those are, you know, sort of arbitrary, aren't they? We established them maybe socially, but we're following them socially. There's nothing uniquely blue about boys.
Right, or pink about girls.
Yeah.
Or as a friend of mine wants to say, like maybe 100, 200 years ago in the English-speaking world, it was the completely opposite, like of the color.
Yeah?
It was like periwinkleish blue was girlish and like a deep pinkish red was like male.
Oh, I see.
So like it can flip or it can drop out of favor or it can, you know, whatever. So yeah, it's easy to knock those type of things down. And the constructionist argument that gender is just a construct of society and doesn't have any sort of essence, it doesn't have any sort of substance of itself, seems almost unanswerable on a surface level for two reasons. One, for the Christian, seems very unanswerable on the surface level for two reasons. One is the, let's call it the blue-pink conundrum, all right? The fact that there are some things society say about men and women that feel kind of arbitrary. The other thing that makes it difficult and seems like gender theory's idea about separating gender and sex this way for the Christian is that Scripture almost takes it for granted that sex and gender are synonymous, that they're just identical, that male and female and masculine and feminine are all bound up together. You know, I remember this is what I said at the Sunday night table. It's like, what, you know, this is one of those things where you almost wish that God had just had a chapter somewhere where it's like, thus saith the Lord, masculinity is X, Y, and Z, and femininity is. So at least we'd have something.
Right.
But we do have something.
Actually, masculinity is XY and femininity is XX.
Yep, my gosh, you can almost literally hear the ta-doom somewhere.
I should have brought my drum set.
It should have. You'll be like Michael Scott in The Office during his own roast. He just had like a drum and cymbal right next to him.
Unbelievable.
And somebody would do a joke he liked to you, just like on his own. You almost wish that, because it's not that we have nothing. As we'll hopefully see in a few nanoseconds as we discuss, we'll use a sort of a springboard, this document we have to discuss. It's not that we have nothing. It's just that it feels like you have to extrapolate and pull out of what we have a whole theory, a biblical theory of gender.
Mm-hmm.
Because what the Bible gives us, like I said, it just sort of takes for granted that sex and gender are just synonymous. They're identical. Masculinity, femininity, maleness, and femaleness are just bound up together.
I think that's how the West has understood that for many years. Certainly is the way I understood it growing up.
Yes.
There's a paragraph talking about your
document
here. Congregation for Catholic Education put out a thing called Male and Female, He Created Them, Toward a Path of Dialogue on the Question of Gender Theory in Education. Well, like a good Thomist, they lay out at the beginning a section that they call listening that really is, like Thomas, laying out a steel man argument for the other side.
Yes, it was very
And I'm grateful for that. I always appreciate not having a kind of straw man opponent laid out. And when they describe this question, we're talking about the difference between sex and gender, I just want to read you a sentence or two from it. This is section 11. It says, in this cultural context, it is clear that sex and gender, as words, are no longer synonyms or interchangeable concepts, since they are used to describe two different realities. Sex is seen as defining which of the two biological categories, deriving from the original feminine-masculine dyad, one belong to. Gender, on the other hand, would be the way in which the differences between the sexes are lived in each culture, just as you said a minute ago.
Right.
The problem here doesn't lie in the distinction between the two terms, which can be interpreted correctly, but in the, and the italics theirs, the separation of sex and gender. And I think that's right. The problem seems to me that gender, in the traditional view of things, gender is a word that describes linguistic background. That is, in certain languages, certain nouns have gender.
Right.
There's in French, table is feminine, and cat is masculine, for example.
Right.
So then nobody wants, I mean, you could say a cat could be male or female, obviously, because there's such a thing as sex for the cat or in that way. But tables don't, cars don't. La voiture is feminine, you see. The car is, the word car is a feminine noun. And that's not to say that it's sexually feminine, it's just gender feminine, right? So gender turns out to be a word that's useful in language, but it's not really applied to anything in accordance with human beings. So people have used gender to describe human beings, but I think it's like you said a minute ago, that sex and gender are kind of interchangeable for the most part.
Right.
But it occurs to me that there is a need for a label for a category that may very well be a useful category that people are calling gender, but I'm not sure I want to use the word gender for. We need a word, let's call it X, that is for the social construction of what we assume men and women should be. Mm. And that actually changes somewhat from culture to culture.
Yeah, sometimes from generation to generation.
And even from generation to generation, like you say. Mm-hmm. So I'm not against the idea of making a distinction. It's just that I don't see how we can separate biological things from the way people are treated in the culture.
Yeah, it's possible that maleness and femaleness are embodied in the body. Masculinity and femininity need to have something that's like, no, they're connected to the body somehow. There's some kind of spiritual reality that the body is revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need a third label. So gender, if you want to guess, is masculine femininity. Maybe that's the term we want for it. But we need a third label for cultural ways of living out men and women. So the thing that changes.
Right.
Because what happens is if you label masculinity and femininity, if you label these sort of essential identities as like fluid and flux, well, then there's no way to know what a man or woman actually is. Like female and male, you can identify them anatomically and biologically.
Right.
But beyond that, it's like, well, what does it mean to be a man? Well, there's really nothing stopping you from saying, well, a male can be whatever you want.
And that's a theological assumption. That what bothers me about that notion is that we're separating the spiritual from the physical altogether. And a Christian can't do that. It's true, a naturalist, you know, a materialist, I suppose, could argue that there isn't any transcendent spiritual sort of model that you're comparing maleness and femaleness to. But the Christian argues that even within the Trinity, there are roles being played. Mm. And so in the invisible Trinity, the Father and the Son actually play roles that are respectively masculine and feminine.
Yeah.
Not male and female, just masculine. Because actually the Son in his risen state is still masculine, or sorry, is male.
Right.
So it's hard to get around the fact that the body is actually intricately tied into now the Trinity.
Right.
But if you dismiss anything spiritual like that and you only look at the physical, then you can't deny that there are biological differences. Maleness and femaleness are inevitable. But masculine and feminine might not have any connection to them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sympathetic with the argument. I just understand it.
Right. I mean, I feel like a materialism is at the root of this in a lot of ways, or a naturalism.
Yeah.
A denial of anything that's a supernatural spiritual reality, that the supernatural and the spiritual is a projection of the brain, or it's a epiphenomenon of matter.
Right.
Regardless, matter is primary, because believing that matter or nature is primary means that when it comes to human beings, their sexual biology is something you can know because it rises out of matter and stuff, but abstract concepts or metaphysical categories like masculine or feminine have to have a material explanation.
Right.
Well, the only material explanation we have for them is that they just arise out of society. So matter, as all there is, materialism and naturalism, but all there is nature, the denial of any sort of spiritual supernatural reality, I think lies at the heart of the denial that sex and gender are connected together in some way.
Right, right.
Because all concepts become arbitrary.
And as I read through this document, I find a fairly well thought through and multifaceted argument from a Christian perspective that connects those two things together. Connects the body with the identity, if you want to say it that way. They make a point of saying there's some things we agree about. In particular, I think they appreciate that women have and femininity have value, but the Bible has always taught that. I think Jesus himself certainly taught that, and I think that is evident in the countries and in nations and societies that have taken up Christian principles. Women have been given far healthier and more fully orbed places in that society. Mm-hmm. But where it disagrees, I think it's interesting. I'm looking at section 20 now. It says, in keeping with the point we were just making, the underlying presuppositions of these theories, that is, these theories about the separation of the two, can be traced back to a dualistic anthropology, separating body from human will, in mm-hmm. this case, which itself becomes an absolute that can manipulate the body as it pleases. We've talked about this idea, you and I, in past podcasts, that ultimately speaking, the unredeemed man wants to extend his will over all his domain. And if he finds that his will desires one thing and his actual body represents something else, mm-hmm. he'll find a way to change, alter, dismiss his physical reality in order to have his will not crossed.
Yeah, and this, again, it traces back to materialism. To state better what I was trying to say earlier, everything is material. Everything is basically matter. Matter can be manipulated.
Right.
It can be changed, transformed.
Right.
Well, how do human beings do it? We have tools, we have technology, but aha, we also have the concepts and ideas that we create from our brains. Like mm-hmm. our brains produce concepts and stuff that allow us to manipulate matter to form societies. Well, if that's the case, then why can't we change those concepts and manipulate things in a different way?
Sure.
So it is a way to manipulate. You need to have a merely everything is matter attitude towards things to have this idea of, well, if it's all matter, then I can manipulate it because I have this power to do so, not only with tools and technology, but even with concepts like gender.
Well, and I think if you go back to the beginning of modern science, you find people like Francis Bacon talking about knowledge being power. So science is a kind of a way to manipulate the material world into the shape that the will wants it to be. Well, eventually you come to your own material shape, which is your own sexuality, maleness or femaleness. And like I say, if that gets in the way, even that can be manipulated. And people are obviously, transgender people are going through all sorts of convoluted ways of trying to accomplish that now, either through hormone therapy or even surgery to adjust themselves physically to the way that their will works, wants it to be. Lewis talks about this in Abolition of Man. We've just been reading with our students anyway. Mm-hmm. And lots of other great writers have addressed this too. I'm thinking of Richard Weaver now, where he says, in the past, people have thought that nature, the created order, owed its existence to a higher power, and it actually being fallen needed to change itself to imitate a higher model, a model beyond itself, right? Mm-hmm. But if we dismiss God and thus dismiss the model, then nature becomes its own thing and in a sense can't be corrected. It is what it is.
Right.
Then you start thinking, let's make a subset of within nature of a kind of hierarchy of power. So human beings become the power in nature, even though we're part of nature. Mm-hmm. And that we use our will and our power to manipulate the rest of nature to be the way we think it ought to be. In the Christian way, we're supposed to be stewards and use that ability and that power to, in a sense, manipulate nature to be more what God intended it to be. Uh-huh. But if you leave him out of the equation, well, then we are the gods, actually, and we're making our own decisions.
The idea of being able to manipulate matter, to be able to manipulate your existence towards your will, creates an interesting wrinkle in the whole sex-gender divide. Because the people who originally postulate that sex and gender are separate, that sex is the biological, anatomical thing, and gender is just a culturally, socially constructed concept, they still held that the sex was something concrete. It was something you could know. It was stable. All right. We knew male, we knew female, we got that. Masculine and feminine, that's an ethereal, nebulous thing that you can make it whatever you will, but the body remains solid.
Yeah.
But in the rise of, in the last like 5 years, it feels like transgenderism as a mainstream idea, and even all the other trans kind of movements that are really fringy, but they're still out there, like transracialism, transageism. Mm-hmm. I was reading about transableism, which are people mm-hmm. who identify as disabled people. So they ask doctors to like deliberately handicap them, like cutting off limbs or blinding our eyes. I don't know how many of them actually go through with it. I do remember reading about one guy who had a doctor surgically remove his leg because he identified as somebody who was crippled that way.
Goodness.
And the only reason the doctor did it is because he was terrified this guy would hurt himself trying to do it himself. He didn't stop it.
Wow.
Transgenderism is like the big mainstream thing, so everyone's on board with that, and they call the other ones fringy and like, oh, that'll never happen, just like, you know, transgenderism was never going to happen either, but whatever. The point is that the world of the trans movements, the different sort of trans attitudes, puts a new wrinkle in this, because suddenly we find, or at least we think we find, that, oh, even the body itself is a construction of society, because how it functions or what it does is told to us by society.
Right.
And if that's the case, and we have the technology, specifically the medical technology, to transform it, well, then it's just more pliable matter that we can shift and change. So even the body itself will undergo transformation. In some ways, this sort of materialism that wants to manipulate all of matter, when it gets to the trans level of things, whereas transgender, trans age, or just transhumanism or something mm-hmm, like that, mm-hmm. all the trans level things are a kind of assault on the body itself. It's like, because the body itself gets in the way of your will. You know, my will says I need my body to be this, so I'm going to use medical science and technology to transform it, because now we have the power to manipulate the matter according to my own will. It's not really true. I mean, we talked, what was it, last year, that article that guy who tried to transition into a woman talked about, that you know, how the vagina they supposedly got, their body will always treat it like a wound.
Right.
Which is an astounding statement. But there's always this thought in the background that, well, maybe one day we'll get the technology, you know, that can actually transform the body any way we want.
Wow.
Right? Some attitude like that.
That's very interesting, because, as you say, it used to be that the body was considered absolute, mm-hmm. inviolable, and somehow more real and firm and solid than the fluidity of gender.
Yes.
But let me just read in section 20 here. He says, they say, the combination of physicalism and voluntarism gives rise to relativism, in which everything that exists is of equal value and at the same time undifferentiated, without any real order or purpose. All of that is brought to it. It doesn't have innate order or purpose. All of that is brought to it. Then it says, in all such theories, from the most moderate to the most radical, there's an agreement that one's gender ends up being viewed as more important mm-hmm. than being male or female. As sex. The effect of this move is chiefly to create a cultural and ideological revolution driven by relativism, and secondarily a juridical revolution since such beliefs claim specific rights for the individual and across society. Mm-hmm. So to begin with, we think sex is sure and more somehow more real and more basic than gender. Right. But now we're saying because gender is fluid and associated with the will of the individual, then that which we thought was solid before, the actual sex of someone, can be adjusted.
Right. Or and more important, ought to be adjusted.
Ought to be adjusted because the will becomes more important than even the body.
Mm-hmm. And that is, in a way, where this document goes to assert its sort of counter-proposal, which is why I looked into this document, this Vatican document. If you're interested in it, we'll probably attach like a link to it somewhere in like the comm box or something like that. It's where they get to the talking about a Christian anthropology, where they're trying to propose an alternative, and it seems like the essence of their Christian anthropology, an alternative vision, as it were, is this sort of centrality of the body. Like, it's sort of a redefense of the body.
Right, right.
Right. Because the body matters, and they take seriously the idea that the Bible sort of takes for granted the idea that sex and gender are bound up and are synonymous in some way. And they recognize persons, human persons, as what they call soul and body. We might say spirit and body, but regardless, as spiritual and physical together.
Right.
And that the body is actually a way that the spiritual is, not to be redundant, but embodied. That it's actually, so the body is actually a clue to your gender.
Mm-hmm.
So they just tie it all back together. And as such, so their whole thing is built around the body has a certain dignity to it and a certain reality to it and a certain, what's the word, certain communication to it, that it communicates gender to the world. And thus, if you want to know, so it takes gender, and instead of making it this fluid, ethereal thing that's simply based on the will, it anchors it to the body and says
right.
that maybe gender is not reducible to the body, but it is definitely bound up in it, and the body and somehow is saying something about it.
It's informed by the body.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a little too much to say that the body is the incarnation of the gender, but if you want to understand that. But I'm thinking in terms of like C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton all the way.
Reminds me of G.K. I've heard of Lewis, but who's this Chesterton?
Chesterton. Chesterton's essay called The Unutterable talked about how all that is good tends toward incarnation, which he was speaking in terms of art, and that the word is always trying to become flesh. And in regards to art, he had this interesting thing. He said that oftentimes the thing we're trying to capture in art, whether it's painting or sculpture or literature or whatever, oftentimes the thing we're trying to capture, our efforts are inadequate to the job.
Right.
Right. You know, like T.S. Eliot talking about, you know, trying to capture things in words because that's his medium. I think it was in one of the four quartets where he talked about words are like an imprecise tool and just never seems to capture what you want. But both he and Chesterton basically say that though it may be inadequate, the effort is still made and the effort is still good. And so, and because something gets communicated, even if it's not communicated all the way.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm thinking when I say that the body is the incarnation. You see the quotation marks I'm using with my hands, of gender, and that the body is a incarnate way, a infleshed way of communicating gender. Maybe it's not always the clearest or adequate because maybe gender or maybe masculinity is a mysterious thing and femininity is a mysterious thing. But we still try, the body still tries to express it.
Mm-hmm.
And so for them, their defense revolves around, or their defense, their counter-proposal.
Mm-hmm.
It's not much of a defense. They're not really, it doesn't sound like you're really arguing with them in this, even though they use the word arguments. It's more like, well, here's where you stand, and here's where we stand. Now let's talk, which is like, okay.
I think that's probably the point of this article.
Right. But their point seems to be about the centrality. They even use the term centrality of the body, I think, here or somewhere. But that's where they go back to, is the defense of the body. Which is an interesting approach.
And you're talking about Eliot and words and paintings and pieces of music and so on.
Yes.
All of those art forms themselves, in a way, are incarnating ideas, aren't they?
Yes.
And experiences and so on, human experience. And so the manifestation of things in physical terms is the way that we communicate these invisible realities. In the same way that the person of Jesus incarnated actually communicates the invisible God. If you've seen me, you've seen the Father, he says. And so in that way, I think even the conversation we're having right now is an attempt to get at and to materialize or to incarnate the ideas that we're wrestling with about human experience.
It says back up in section 24 that there are rational arguments to support the centrality of the body as that which communicates identity of being.
Uh-huh.
Right,
uh-huh.
So it's this idea, the body is an integrating element of personal identity. It's a, they call it a subjectivity that communicates identity of being. They're using a lot of John Paul II's terminology there. Basically, the body is a thing that grounds your identity, mm-hmm. of your mm-hmm. sexual identity, as well as mm-hmm. other things, and as a means of communicating it. And, of course, that runs afoul of the whole idea that, you know, the two things are separate. For them, the body is central. And I think the real fight, and I don't know if they make this clear enough, but the real fight here would be trying to argue that, well, like I said, they don't make it very clear, and I'm not sure about this argument, just that I can feel that the resistance would be that by saying the body grounds gender, gender is thereby reduced to and exhausted by the body.
Mm-hmm.
And something like that, which maybe creates its own kind of problems. But that's the gist of their sort of response.
And I certainly hold to that as a Christian. I think they're right about that. And I'm not as convinced that it's a compelling argument for someone who doesn't hold a Christian understanding of cosmos or anthropology. Mm. And that's why I was saying to you, I think, before we started, that I agree with the arguments that the Catholics are making here. As Christian arguments, I don't even think of them as Catholic. I just think of them as Christian arguments. But they're not exactly addressing. If you buy on the front end that the two things are separate, I'm not sure that this position would convince you to give it up.
Right.
In other words, it doesn't hit the nail on the head to show the problems with the contradictions of and all that. It just shows how a Christian picture, frankly, is more multifaceted, more rich, more robust, I think, in its picture of the world.
Yeah.
And many times that's convincing. Okay, I'm not saying that's not going to convince anybody.
Right.
But I would love to actually address what it is that the unbeliever wants by distinguishing between sex and gender that's good.
Mm-hmm.
And we were touching on it when we said blue and pink kind of things, because there are cultural sort of things that really change over time, and maybe you want to have a category that describes those things and frankly allows for a little fluidity. Mm-hmm. What it means to be a man is to always hold the checkbook,
yeah.
you know, or something. Always drive the car or something. Those sorts of things they're not necessary to
sure.
to masculinity, to maleness.
Don't worry, I'm trying to rack my brain for a millennial version of those things. Like, what's a guy? It's kind of hard. We're so weird about that stuff now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, you're right. It's like,
well, I want a place where I can say this is not to be so tightly wound, you know, bound. To maleness and femaleness. But at the same time, I don't want, just because I can see that there are those things that don't tie themselves so tightly, that I want to give up the idea that there's, you know, there's a connection between our biological maleness and our
masculinity. I think that is the real trick, because in my own experience, now I'm not talking about the document anymore, my own thought, yeah. my own experience trying to reflect on these things and observe these things, the problem always seems to be if either we let this thing be separate and thus gender can be fluid and stuff like that and free, or we revert to a suffocating, stuffy, rigid rationalism that just perfectly dots all the I's and crosses all the T's and checks all the boxes and gives a roadmap that is comprehensive.
Yeah.
So it's like either we have gibberish but freedom or comprehension but tyranny. It's mm-hmm. like that. That's our two things. And I'm like,
right.
No, there's got to be like the middle road. That sounds too much like Chesterton's Madman and the Suicide of Thought, right?
Uh-huh.
It's like those are your options, right? Either everything rationalistically clamped down or everything just completely thrown up into chaos, mm-hmm. and something that shoots the middle and says there are verities and realities that we can know and they're concrete and we can state them with surety, and there is mystery and complexity and other things at the same time.
Right, right.
And like some way to articulate that and a way to, and here's where the problem comes in, is to attest those two things and to be able to attest where the line is between the things we can know for sure and the things that are mysterious. Because that's where it's like, well, how do you know when guys like blue and girls like pink, how do you know when that's stupid? But then another person says, well, guys do X and girls do Y, and that's actually saying something more essential.
Right.
Like, where is that line? It's like, it's almost like, almost the other two ways are almost like a kind of moral laziness in some ways. It's like, well, let's just give a total blueprint for everything, so now we don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
Or, well, I hate thinking
or
about
let's
it.
Let's just stop thinking about it altogether.
Yeah, it's like, let's take back up the mature adult work of trying to actually figure this out.
Right, right. Well, I have a thought.
Do you now?
I do. Look at number 27, paragraph 27, under the reasoning part of this. He says, they say, I keep saying he, but I think there are two fellows that wrote this. The formation of one's identity is itself based on the principle of otherness. Since it's precisely the direct encounter between another, quote, you, who is not me, that enables me to recognize the essence of the I, who is me. I'm just wondering. I think that much of what we understand as masculine and feminine are associated with the way that we interact with each other, and maybe that's what they're getting at. So that I don't really know what it is to be a man until I'm in the presence of a woman and actually have to kind of hammer out a relationship, you know, how to work it out. And I'm thinking maybe then what the Bible teaches about what they're calling sex is very obvious, male and female. But what it teaches about gender is the relationship of submission one to another. And we take up, frankly, we take up roles in our relationships with each other. An employee to an employer, for example, or a wife to a husband, or a child to a parent. All of these are described in the New Testament, and think about Ephesians 5 in particular. What if the first call in that Ephesians 5 is submit to one another out of love, first of all? It's a general concept. But then it goes into some very specific ways that people should relate to each other and submit to one another. And they are profound if you read them through. Maybe gender, what we call gender, is the last shreds of that sort of biblical understanding of how people take up roles and live them out with each other and find harmony in that, you know? Because if, for example, again, if you take God out of your equation, but you've got generations of traditional marriage where the wife submits to the husband, then people start saying, well, what it means to be feminine is to act like this wife, you see. Right. Or what it means to be masculine is to act like a husband. Husbands, sacrifice yourselves for the benefit of your wife. Wives, love your husbands and so on, as the church loves the Lord. But if there's no more Lord and there's no more church and there's no more God in anybody's minds, they're still there, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I understand.
Then maybe what we've got when we talk about gender roles are just the last sort of shreds of the shrouds of fog as they, you know, disappear from the glory of this mutual submission harmony that we were using before.
C.S. Lewis, I wish, spoke more about gender identity and theory, because the moments where he does sort of kind of skirt the edges of it, it just feels like he's touching something. One of the closest times he gets, and I've mentioned this before, maybe on the podcast, but I know I've mentioned it before outside of it, is in Paralandra, where Ransom, you know, near the end, he runs into the Eldils, the Eldil for Venus and the Eldil for Mars. You know, the Eldil from Paralandra and the Eldil from Malachandra. And they're supposed to represent, like, Venus and Mars, Aries and Aphrodite, all these sort of mythological things. They're like the idealized, they're the actual angelic spiritual essence and reality and intelligence that everything about them, all that stuff got transmitted through mythology and stuff like that.
Right.
Well, their intelligence is because they're angels, so they have to, like, incarnate somehow. and they usually incarnate in like forms of light. But when they incarnate themselves before Ransom here, they still incarnate in a way that's in keeping with their essence, the intelligible essence that they are. Mm-hmm. And so when he sees Paralandra and he sees Malacandra, he sees them as essentially feminine and masculine.
Mm-hmm.
Not female or male.
Right.
C.S. Lewis makes a very interesting point to distinguish that. It's that they were sexless. They mm-hmm. were not male and female. They had no secondary sexual characteristics whatsoever. But when you looked at Paralandra, she was feminine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in its most essential form. And when you looked at Malacandra, he was masculine in like an essential form without any sexual characteristics whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And then he goes into trying to describe them, and I almost feel like this is the closest I've ever heard someone trying to really express the mystery of it. And of course, it's only done in the context of a story, which is, you know, an imaginative, metaphorical work of art. And the way he describes them is beautiful and fascinating, but he said something. He said that it's like somehow they were reflective of a fundamental polarity at the base of things.
Right.
And the fact that he used the word polarity, whereas our society likes the word binary, mm-hmm. which suggests just two points in relation, mm-hmm. but polarity suggests two points that are actually in a dynamic sort of movement with each other, was interesting to me. That there's some kind of, it's not just relation of like one point and one point, two points on a line, and they're like have a logistical relation. It's like there's an actual dynamism between right. the two that's going on. A sort of, they're supposed to be connected together. They're supposed to be in dynamic relation.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds to me like that's the same thing, that's connected to what you're talking about, that it's in relation with others that you suddenly reveal who you are, like who you actually are. It's not a creative thing, like you're a blank slate and then you get in a relation with something and suddenly you start building it. It's more like, there was someone on Sunday, I think it was actually one of the girls at the table, mm-hmm. said that it was funny to her how she'll have friends who are guys who like just seem like neutral ciphers in a way. And so they start to like a girl and then they start to try and relate to the girl and suddenly masculineness of some sort, not necessarily yeah. a cliche sort, but just of some sort starts to just manifest, almost like it was there the whole time, but it's not until that, you know, substance comes in contact with that magnetic force that it starts to react towards it.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's a reaction, uh-huh. there's a, or something happens, there's a sure. reaction of some kind,
sure.
and it causes something to rise out of it. So
I think you're trying to say that you agree with my take on
yes.
this, that maybe they're best defined when they're coming into contact with each other.
Yes.
And until that point, it's not so clear. And it's also understandable that when the will that thinks of itself as primary sees something that's different than itself, then it may very well respond by saying, I don't want that. I want what I know in myself. I want somebody like me, in other words.
Yes.
And in a sense, that would make sense in that context. But what we're finding is, I think if we even are pretty good scientists, is that there's a fruit that comes from this dynamic thing you're talking about, that is the two poles interacting with each other. And we see it, and you know, the farmer plants seed in the ground and it grows into a plant, right? Yeah. The husband and the wife come together and become parents. The fruit of their bodies or their interaction with the ground and so on is the fruit of it is made possible in that dynamism. And it's interesting that the homosexual relationship is maybe more attractive to some people and at the same time sterile. Because there's not that dynamism, there's not that harmony, and so it's actually a kind of threatening thing to engage with someone who's different than you are. You know? A girl thinking that boys are very different. Boys thinking girls are very different, right? As the French say, vive la différence.
Right.
I mean, we're glad for that difference. Right. But shouldn't be taken for granted that difference is going to not be threatening.
Right.
It is. It's challenging. But that's where it happens. That's where the life happens. That's where bear fruit.
I think there's something to the dynamism thing that it. That's how this thing pulls out. I can't even find the right words for it. Like, this is how the thing that's there rises out of it.
Right.
Right. Like, even in my own life, you know, my own wife is, you know, perfectly independent, well-possessed woman who considers herself a strong feminist in like a first wave sense. She went to college, got a creative writing degree. She worked in the corporate world and stuff like that. But when we got married, she was really concerned that I'm fed.
Isn't that nice? That I am
fed well. And, like, and of course, me, coming from my swinging bachelor days, was like, oh, I'll just eat, like, a whatever for lunch. It's like, because I'll have a big dinner. And she, there were times, it was really funny, and she'll probably kick me for saying these things, but whatever. not whatever. I love you, honey. But I would, like, eat, like, I don't know, like, just a sandwich for lunch here. Like, I would come here, and I'd just have, like, a little sandwich and eat, like, hey, Hodges, whatever. And then I come home, and she's like, they saw you eating just a sandwich. And I'm like, well, yeah, what's wrong with that? They're going to think I starve you.
Oh, I see,
like,
yeah.
And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, I hadn't even thought in those circles before. But she suddenly is really concerned that I get fed.
Yeah.
Which is a really, like, cliche wife to husband thing, right?
Yeah.
And yet, I didn't tell her to do that, or
of course not.
Push her into it, or fall into it. She like is an independent minded person. That's not like, you know, her own upbringing is forcing this upon her.
Sure.
It just sort of comes out. It just came out of nowhere. It's something like that. There's something there that is deeply mysterious, and all our attempts to sort of embody it are inadequate, and sometimes, like in the pink and blue situation, maybe, you know, really inadequate, but it still wants to come out. It wants to be embodied in some way and expressed in some
way. There is something there. I was interested in one of the girls' responses last Sunday night. She said, I think somebody said, well, if you were on a desert island with no one else around you, you know, how would you live? And she immediately said, I'd build a home.
Right.
And I thought that was really interesting. She said, that's my inner self. That's what I want to do. I make homes.
And I think I said, like, my first thought was to go kill something and get, you
know, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'd have to go and eat, kill and hunt.
That was almost like instinctive. It was kind of funny.
But it's not, I mean, you can't just say, well, that means every person, you know, does this and every other person does that.
Right. That's the rationalistic tendency.
Exactly. Right? But at the same time, you can't deny that the predisposition almost is in certain directions. And there's always somebody that is not, you know, in line with the generality. But that's what a generality is, right? It's generally true, but it's not always true.
They say it's like generalities are right 51% of the time.
51% of the time. Exactly.
I mean, that really is, I've said this before, and I'm just restating the same thing in a more clear way. I said the problem was like trying to delineate between like when we're dealing with just mystery and we don't know, and when we can actually speak with some sort of surety about something.
Yeah.
And I think, on the one hand, there are realities that are bigger than us and are, in varying degrees, incomprehensible, you know, in some ways. Like, God is the true capital I, incomprehensible.
Right.
But there are all these things around us that are incomprehensible, but they keep getting in our face. Like, they won't leave us alone. It would be so much simpler, Hodges, if everything could be reduced to theorems and algorithms and categories, and we just figured it out. What's this action? Oh, let's check the categorical chart. Ah, there it is. We know.
Yeah.
That'd be so much easier. Or it would be so much easier. It's like, well, actually, everything is just a giant toss-up, and who knows and who cares. And reality won't let us get away with either. If we try to say, oh, we'll check out the category, reality blows up all our categories. But if we try to live without any lines or categories, suddenly reality takes vengeance on us that way and says, no. Mm-hmm. You try to act all flippant and willy-nilly, and then suddenly you don't farm the ground right, you get a dust bowl.
Exactly.
As far as I've gotten on this whole issue, Hodges, is that sex is the body and gender is a spiritual reality of masculinity and femininity that our bodies reveal but are not reducible to the body.
Uh-huh.
And as such, they're knowable, but they're still mysterious at the same time. And that's where the conundrum comes in, and the people's attempt to resolve the conundrum by either doing a rationalistic drawing the box around it perfectly or a nihilistic there are no boxes, there never were boxes, there was no meaning to it whatsoever, both fall apart because there actually is a thing there, it's just a mysterious thing that is actually revealed in some way, but it's not totally revealed, but it's there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
That's about as far as I've gotten.
I think that's good, and I think I would add to that, I agree with you, and I would add to that the definition of that spiritual aspect is very real outside of us, but mysterious to us. But it also gets revealed in the relationship of one to the other, and can be even guided by God's revelation to us about how we might relate to one another. Mm-hmm. So it brings forth our human nature, let's say, our natures, which includes a design from God, which has to include this idea of the relationship between the sex and the gender, how they're tied together. If they're not a unison, they are so closely tied together that you can't separate them from each other.
Yes.
But that the masculine and feminine parts actually get played out in various ways in relationships in this world. The same man, for example, that is a husband at home playing what you might call the masculine role in that marriage, goes off to work and takes up the employee relationship with an employer, meaning that in a sense he's taking up the feminine role in relationship to the employer. And that kind of relationship actually makes for a smooth home. It also makes for a smooth business. But the same person, in a sense, can play multiple roles, you see. So what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a good man? It at least means the characteristics that Jesus has revealed to us. But I think one of the wonderful things that came out of our discussion on Sunday night was that whatever it means to be a good man, there's also the definition of a good woman, or maybe better used to say, a good man is a gentleman and a good woman is a lady. Mm. And that means that the gentleman and the lady are the ones that take up these roles and relate to one another with respect. You know, recognizing that I am in a body, and that body is defining of my roles as masculine or feminine in various different relationships. And as I take those things up, I respect the masculine or feminine that I'm engaged with across the thou, as it says here, the other. And that means that you're not, the temptation, of course, is in our day and age, is to take a definition and then claim it to not only be a definition, which is, as you said, dangerous because of the mystery involved, but also then to say that it's somehow superior to the other. And that, I think, we can never say.
No.
So I may take up a role, I may recognize the relationship between my maleness and my masculinity in various situations, but at the same time, respect the feminine and the other, in my case, when she would do the same, respecting the other and the masculine, and in doing so, build a kind of harmony that way. Never saying, my way is the superior one.
Yeah,
if you could just be more like me. Yeah. But that's the temptation of the fallen man in all cases, right? Fallen person. Everybody wants to say, well, clearly the way I'm doing it is the right way.
Right.
You know, well, that's not just.
You said earlier that this Vatican document is, you agree with a lot of it, but it doesn't sound like it's going to be very compelling outside of, like, say, a Christian circle, and maybe not even compelling outside of a Catholic circle. What would make a more compelling argument? And I feel like I'm stepping in dangerous territory. It's like, Hodges, give me a top-down compelling argument against gender theory. I'm not sure if I'm asking a content question as much as I'm asking like a formal question. Like, what would it look like? Would you say, Hodges, that this Catholic document is like somebody positing a good piece of literature, but they don't go one step further and compare and contrast the good to the bad and show why the good is actually a superior way of looking at gender to the bad?
Great question. The answer is yes.
Okay.
I think what they are trying to do, and you can see it from the title of the article, is to start a dialogue, to be able to converse intelligently with those who disagree. And I think what they did was, as I said before, lay out a steel man argument for the humanist materialist position, and then address where they agree with it, where they disagree, which I find compelling. That's a great way to approach an argument. It's very Thomistic, and it's reasonable and healthy and respectful. Mm-hmm. But I think what they do is they give this multifaceted, I think very rich Christian picture of the biblical understanding of maleness and femaleness as connected to masculinity and femininity, or gender and sex connected together. But what they don't do is maybe show very clearly why it is that you can't hold the position that the humanist holds. That would be more compelling to me. I would think I like to put myself in the shoes of the other guy and hear the argument from the Christians and see if that argument actually would address my concerns. And I think once you assume on the front end that there is no connection necessarily between sex and gender, I don't know that anything they gave us is going to address that directly. There was one number in there, it seemed like, in their rational argument section. Let me just read that part, and I'll show you what I mean. Mm-hmm. I think in the reasoning segment, yes. Number 25, it says, the process of identifying sexual identity is made more difficult by the fictitious construct known as gender neuter or third gender, which has the effect of obscuring the fact that a person's sex is a structural determinant of male and female identity. That's about as close as they come. But what they're saying is, it seems to me, if I boiled that down, they're saying, you say sex and gender are separate. No, they aren't.
Yes.
And it's more difficult to see that if you believe on the front end that sex and gender are different.
Right.
Well, that's not a logical argument. That doesn't scratch where I itch.
It doesn't have any sap in it.
That's right.
Blood in it.
It's right. It's right.
Yes.
Right. But it's not compelling. And by the way, just another point about what I said at the very beginning. Look at this. It's saying the process is made more difficult by a construct known as gender neuter. Again, neuter is a word that is used primarily in language. Mm-hmm. There are neuter nouns.
Yes.
You see? So it's almost as though they've gone to linguistic theory and they've borrowed terms that really apply to language and insisted that they become categories within this whole debate about gender and sexuality. We do use the word neuter, don't we? I mean, if you neuter a dog, for example, you keep him from reproducing. That's the male version. I guess the female version is spaying. We use the word spay.
Yes.
To describe basically neuter, making a dog no longer able to reproduce.
Right.
And so in that sense, it is a kind of biological word, neuter. But we never use that word for people.
Yeah.
You know, we don't do that. We just don't. We would think of that as almost Nazi-ish, horrible to do. But so it looks to me like it's a sort of linguistic sleight of hand to take terms that really don't apply and then insist that they become categories within our discussion, simply for the practicality of making my will for a new thing possible. I'm just going to. I want to have a third gender, or I want to have neuter. So I'm going to draw on that, and I'm going to make it something that really didn't exist before. So while I don't think they're wrong, I think this is, like I said before, a Catholic, and I would say Christian, simply biblical Christian approach to the relationship between those two words, I'd like to find something that would address the category that the humanist wants that I think you and I both agree has some validity. That is, that whole pink and blue idea, yeah. things like that. We want something that would describe a kind of socially constructed aspect that doesn't have the kind of absolute authority that maleness and femaleness has, biological maleness and femaleness. But I think the way to start that would be to argue that the only way you can see only is an exclusive word. Maybe that's not fair. But the best way to see the distinctions between male masculinity and femininity is to put the two in context with each other. And then I think for the Christian, it's pushing that contrast or pushing that relationship all the way up the scale from, say, husbands and wives to Christ and the church, and then from the Christ and the church to the Father and the Son and the Trinity, mm-hmm. which is the ultimate in reality. That's what reality looks like.
Right.
And that's what Lewis is getting at, really, with his Paralandra and Malacandra kind of idea. So I think it's possible to craft something that would be addressing their concern and yet not allowing for it to dissolve the relationship between the body and the gender.
I think that's where it has to start, and I guess that's where we can conclude on that point for all our listeners out there, that going forward, because our kids are going to deal with it, and grandkids probably, unless something really seismic happens and changes the social order in some way to something else, but yeah, they're going to have to deal with it. But we're going to have to deal with it too. I mean, we're going to be kicking around for decades more as things go by. We're going to have to deal with it too. And it's not enough to just simply sneer at it, of course. But it's also not enough to just do the Gaia Sentitius debunking.
Yeah.
Because that doesn't compel anything either.
Right.
But it's also not enough, like this very wonderful document from the Vatican, to simply propose, look at, here's our thing.
Yeah.
Right? You have to somehow show how our thing, if I could put it that way, answers the questions better.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
For me, yeah. that was always the thing that was most compelling. If somebody asked me, like, why are you a Christian? There's all kinds of complicated reasons, but the one I typically give them is that because it answers the questions better.
Right.
Like, way better. And that's an experiential thing. It's the more I study other forms of thought, the more the Trinity and the Incarnation and the Christ and all that stuff makes sense of everything better than everything else.
Right.
And
right,
it's trying
right.
to get to that point to show how, yes, do we have our own theory of gender, biblical and creedal and traditional, fully Christian? Okay, but how does it answer the questions of gender better?
Right.
Than contemporary gender theory does. That's the task that needs to be.
Sometimes I think the Christians make the mistake of simply dismissing the other guy's argument.
Very nice.
And not offering a positive argument of his own. So there's never a time when we can simply say, you're wrong, and leave it at that.
Yeah.
We need to say, this is what we believe, and let me show you this picture and let you decide for yourself if you think it's more attractive, more multifaceted, answers the questions better, like you're saying. But I think, too, it's not enough just to say, this is what we believe, isn't it beautiful? And I'm all for that. I argue for that all the time, okay, because I think people usually do that first thing wrong. Mm. But there does come a time when you have to say, not only this is why I'm a Christian, but this is why your position actually doesn't work.
Yeah.
You see? And I think in apologetics, that's part of the work. And I guess that's why I felt like it was missing that element. I'd like to be able to say what's good about your making a distinction between the two of them without losing the healthiness of having them speak to one another, yes. relate to one another. So, anyway.
Recommendations, sir.
Well, there's a book that we're going to read this year with the students,
yeah,
called The Roots of American Order. And I'm finding it very interesting. I'm just getting into it now. We haven't actually assigned some of it yet for the students, but we will. But The Roots of American Order, I thought, this is by Russell Kirk, famous conservative, American conservative writer. Paleoconservative, can I say that?
Sure.
Not just conservative, because some people misunderstand that. But when I first saw the title, I've been always been a Russell Kirk fan, but when I saw the title of this, I thought, well, this is just going to be talking about the history of America or the history of the founding documents of America or the order of our government, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I find quickly that it isn't just that. It does speak to a degree about the genius of our founding documents and our founders and so on. But what it really talks about is the history of ideas. And that's what is so essential to what we're doing here at the center. So it goes back to the Greeks and talks about what Greek ideas there were, what Roman ideas there were that influenced us, what goes through the medieval period. It talks about the genius of Christianity itself and the ideas that come from it in terms of what it means to be a human being, what it means to relate to God and to what is virtue and so on. And all those sorts of things have an effect on American order and our government and so on. But he says very early on in the introduction that when he says order, he's not talking about the order of government, like a republic or a democracy or something like that, which is what I assumed he meant. He's talking about the order of our affections. And that, as you know, is key to all that we're doing here at the center, too. Mm-hmm. The kind of Augustinian idea of the ordo amoris, the ordering of our loves.
Yeah.
And so when he says at the beginning that I'm interested in order, he says I'm interested in the order of our loves. That is key to reviving and reestablishing a Christian view of the world, I think, in our day. So I recommend it. I think it's a good book. I've only gotten in the third of the way through, so if somebody's listening to this and has finished it and disagreed with something at the end, don't assume I didn't disagree with it too. But so far, anyway, I'm very impressed, and The Roots of American Order by Russell Kirk will take you a long way to understanding the history and history of ideas in the West.
I'm going to, as a sort of point counterpoint maneuver,
good.
I'm going to recommend almost the polar opposite.
Okay.
In my
good.
Recommendations, I'm going to recommend the Communist Manifesto.
Excellent.
If you have not read it before, it is really short, and you can technically skip the fourth part because it's just listing all the here's the Communist Party of Poland or something like that. It's not that fascinating. But it's in four parts. And the fourth one you can skip because it just lists the different Communist Party organizations. They're recognizing them. And the third one, if you want to, they try and trace some interesting conceptions of socialism. But the first two parts, the bourgeois, the proletarian, and then the proletarian and the communist, are just mind-blowing
mm-hmm.
segments.
Mm-hmm.
Because
certainly are.
Even though this type of classical Marxist come communist sort of thing has in many ways transformed and tweaked and permutated and mutated and has done all kinds of things, particularly in response to that whole problematic, you know, totalitarian communist society things of the 20th century, still, I couldn't help but read the Communist Manifesto, especially the second part, and get like, my gosh, it really has not changed much at all, has
right.
it? In some ways,
right.
in its essence, in its heart. There's some kind of kernel heart of transformative nature of society, and everything that came beforehand is all garbage, and we know it because, I don't know, because we're the smart ones who mm-hmm. like figured it out. Mm-hmm. It was amazing how, especially, I said the second part, especially, it was amazing to see how that stuff still resonates with what's going on today. And this is particularly true of the first part, you get a little glimpse of why somebody would buy into this stuff.
Yes.
Because their critique of a liberal capitalist society has teeth to it. It has mm-hmm. it has bite. It has punch. It's really hard to look at their conception of this consumerist society that change happens so rapidly that everything dissolves into nothingness before it even has a chance to solidify. It's really hard to not look at that and go, yeah, that is kind of problematic, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? It's really hard to.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll get some sense of why Marxist influence is still here, even mm-hmm. though it's like transformed in all kinds of interesting and crazy ways, and also why it still has bite to it, because I am slowly getting convinced that the essence of it has not changed.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend the Communist Manifesto, whatever translation you can find. It's super short. And like I said, you can skip the fourth part because it's just a listing of communist parties that probably don't exist anymore. I would get it. And that is my recommendation.
Very good, very good. I agree. That's a good thing to read.
That is our podcast for today. This has been From the Center, and we'll see you next time.
Have a good week.